Our previous study, at the end of 1 Samuel, when the Philistines had defeated the Israelites, and Saul took his own life, he was injured in battle, and rather than have the enemy kill him, he took his own life on Mount Gilboa at the end of 1 Samuel. At the beginning of 2 Samuel, in chapter 1, we come against an odd story which seems to conflict with the story you have in the final chapter of 1 Samuel. A man comes and he claims to have dispatched Saul. And he thought, it appears to me, that he was going to get some sort of prize from David because he had got rid of David's enemy. I rather suspect that this man was embellishing some story or making up something to make himself appear something that he wasn't. But if he hoped to get David's reward, he was disappointed because he got killed instead. One thing we noted last week was that time and again David refused to lift his hand against the Lord's anointed. He would do nothing to retaliate against Saul. He would do nothing to attack Saul. All he was doing was seeking to defend his own life. And he maintains that principle here. In chapter 1, verse 14, David said to him, "How is it you were not afraid to put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Whereupon in verse 15, David called upon one of his young men to go and kill the man who had killed the king. The remainder of the chapter is then taken up with a lament as David mourns the parting of Saul and Jonathan. In chapter 2, you find that David now is established as king. Now, if you just look briefly at this map, first of all, look at verse 4 of chapter 2. Verse 3, David brought up his men who were with him, everyone with his household, and they dwelt in the towns of Hebron. And the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. The town Hebron and Judah are in the south here. Now the battle had been fought by the Philistines who came from this area, who'd moved up the coastal plain across the plain of Megiddo, and the main attack had been in the northern section there around the plain of Jezreel. And it was in Mount Gilboa, just at the side there, that Saul was slain. So all of this area had fallen now under the control of the Philistines. But the southern part here, Judah, was still free of Philistine domination. And Hebron, in the middle of the southern portion, in the middle of the tribe of Judah, Hebron now becomes David's center. And he is declared king here. But you find that Saul had a son called Ish-bosheth, and Abner, who was Saul's commander-in-chief, Abner then declared Ish-bosheth king in succession of his father Saul. So you have two kings. But because a lot of this area west of the River Jordan was now under the Philistines' control, when Abner declared Ish-bosheth king, he went over here to Mahanaim on the other side of the river, east of Jordan, and had Ish-bosheth crowned king there. It only lasted for 2 years because Ish-bosheth was very weak, and he fairly soon crumbled. We'll just look at the details there. In chapter 2, verse 3, we saw how that David dwelt in and around Hebron, and verse 4, the men of Judah appointed him king. Down to verse 8, we find that Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, had taken Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim, brought him over onto the other side of the river. And there he became king over the areas of Gilead, the Asherites, Jezreel, Ephraim and Benjamin, which roughly speaking means the area this side of the river plus those remaining areas west of the river which had not been conquered by the Philistines. It was by no means an all-embracing kingdom which he ruled. He ruled what the Philistines had left over. And in verse 10 we are told that Ish-bosheth was 40 years old when he began to reign, and he lasted only 2 years. When you come to chapter 3, you find that throughout this 2 years, in the opening verse, there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. David grew stronger, the house of Saul grew weaker. Abner was the power behind Ish-bosheth. But now Ish-bosheth must have realized that Abner was a danger to his own position, and he then engineered a way of getting rid of Abner. He accused Abner of, in verse 7, last part of verse 7, he accused Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" Taking the former king's concubine was a sign that a person was claiming the throne. You'll find three or four references to it in the books of Samuel, and you'll find it again in the books of Kings. You'll recall when David took Bathsheba, how God said to him, I gave your master's concubines into your bosom. Why were you not satisfied? You see, the new king inherited the harem of the former king. The same thing applies later on when Absalom had his rebellion against David. And we know again how he took his father's concubines. That was the open declaration that he had inherited the palace and the harem. You have it again in Kings, when Adonijah asked for a woman who was known as David's concubine. And again it was interpreted as a threat to the throne, as somebody who wanted to take over himself. When Ish-bosheth came to Abner with this accusation, in verse 7 of chapter 3, obviously he was accusing Abner of plotting to take over himself. Abner, we find, was incensed at this. He, in fact, had been the one who had helped Ish-bosheth to succeed, and now Ish-bosheth was accusing him of this. And the upshot of it all was that Abner transferred his allegiance from Ish-bosheth to David. And once Abner had deserted Ish-bosheth, Ish-bosheth's very shaky kingdom simply collapsed. So that was the end of that. And as you read the story on into chapter 4, what happens is that two other zealous young men came and assassinated Ish-bosheth. Now once again they thought they were going to get David's praise. And they came and said to David, we've killed your enemy. Once again we find that David dispatched them. Because if there was one thing that David had made sure all along, it was this. He was not going to get Saul's throne through murder or violence. He had refrained from attacking Saul, and likewise he had refrained from any sort of personal attack on Ish-bosheth. He wanted it to be clear to everybody that his appointment to the throne was by God and by God alone, and he was not going to be party to any sort of move whatever that was trying to get rid of Saul and his household by violence. In chapter 4, verse 9, these two chaps, Rechab and Baanah, came and told David what they'd done, and David said to them, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life out of every adversity, he says, once before when somebody told me Saul is dead and they thought he was bringing me good news, I seized him and slew him at Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more, when wicked men have slain a righteous man in his own house upon his bed, shall I not now require his blood at your hand and destroy you from the earth? Whereupon David commanded his young men, and they killed the two assassins. David was now undisputed ruler. He ruled for a further number of years in Hebron. In verse 5 of chapter 5, we find that David ruled at Hebron over Judah for 7 years and 6 months. Now the first 2 years of that rule had been during the time when Ish-bosheth was trying to establish himself. The remaining 5.5 years, David ruled over the whole of Israel. But it wasn't very satisfactory, as you can see, ruling over the whole of Israel from Hebron down here in the south. There was always tension between Judah and the other tribes. Judah here in the south, the other tribes in the north. There would be even more tension if David sought to rule from the south here. Over those 5.5 years, slowly but surely, David managed to regain a lot of the territory that the Philistines had taken. But he then got a plan which struck him as being ideal for the unification of all the people and to get all the people behind him, because up until now it was mainly the people of Judah who were enthusiastic for him, and the others he still had to win their hearts. He therefore settled on the idea of conquering Jerusalem, because Jerusalem, as you can see, was midway between the northern and southern parts, and it so happened that Jerusalem was under the control of the Jebusites. It had been under the control of the Jebusites ever since Israel conquered the land. They had never been able to take Jerusalem. If David could take Jerusalem, that would be the perfect site for his capital. It would be in nobody's territory, so nobody could be accused of favoritism. And the fact that he would take it from the Jebusites would be sure to win him the support of everybody right through the nation. So he set out on the bold task of taking Jerusalem. It was very difficult to take. It was built on a hill with steeply sloping sides. It was well fortified with a fortress on the main hill in the city. And the people who inhabited the town, the Jebusites, they were so confident that they said even the lame and the blind who sit around the walls could beat off any attack. Methods of ancient warfare meant that Jerusalem was very, very difficult to take. So So David offered it as a prize, and he said, now who's going to go up and take Jerusalem? And in chapter 5, verse 6, the king and his men went to Jerusalem, that's David and his men, went against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, who had mocked David by saying he couldn't come in there. But in verse 7, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. And that was the great pinnacle of David's career, the conquest of Jerusalem. Once he had taken the city, it was to be not only his capital, but also the religious center of the nation. You find now, as you go over to verse 6, that David proceeded, chapter 6, that David proceeded to make Jerusalem the religious center. The Ark of the Covenant, for the last 20-odd years, had not been in the tabernacle at all. Remember how it was taken from the tabernacle and lost in the Philistines, and they put it on a cart and it came back, and then you had people who were destroyed because they looked into it, and then the ark was put into a house, just a country house, in a village called Kiriath Jearim or Baal Judah, and it remained there right through the reign of Saul. Saul had no interest in the religious life of the nation. David set out to rectify the problem and to restore the ark to its rightful place as the center of Israel's religion. The tabernacle was at Gibeon, but there was no ark in the tabernacle. The ark was in this farmhouse. David then brought the ark from the farmhouse to Jerusalem, and he established a special tent in Jerusalem to house the ark as a sort of temporary sanctuary. Chapter 6, verse 10, David set out to bring the ark into Jerusalem. He'd tried once before, and when somebody had tried to stop it from falling off the cart, the person who touched it was smitten dead. Whereupon David left it alone for a few months. But when God blessed the house in which the ark was situated, in verse 11, the house of Obed-Edom, when God blessed that house, David must have realized that the reason for God's punishment was not that he was shifting the ark, but that he had done so in the wrong fashion. So when he set out the second time to do it, he put the ark on in its poles, and the Levites carried it in the proper manner instead of trying to transport it upon a cart, which was not the right way to do things at all. So when they started the second time to move the ark, in verse 13, they were so relieved that nothing happened to them. When they had gone only 6 paces, they stopped and sacrificed an ox and a fatling, thanking God that he had been gracious to them and not smitten them dead. Whereupon the procession continued, and finally it reached Jerusalem. We have the story then of it going up the hill to the Mount Zion, where David had his tent for it. The story of David leaping and praising God and his wife Michal not being impressed. And you come to verse 17, they brought in the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent which David had pitched for it. And then David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. David has conquered Jerusalem, he's brought the ark in, the symbol of God's presence, and Jerusalem now is the center of Israel's national religious life. I want to leave it there now. Can we look at a couple of psalms which I believe tie in with these events? 68 would be the first one. It seems to me that there are a number of psalms which possibly were written by David to celebrate the great event of the bringing of the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem upon David's conquest of the city. Psalm 68 seems to be some sort of celebration of that sort. We are not told exactly what the circumstances are, but nevertheless we are told it is a psalm of David. It opens up with God scattering his enemies, shattering them. And in verse 2, as smoke is driven away and as wax melts before fire, so Israel's enemies melt before them. God has won a great victory. They've taken Jerusalem, and now the ark is coming. From verse 4, as you move on down through the psalm, which we won't read, David recounts something of the journey of Israel from Mount Sinai through the wilderness, conquest of Canaan, to this great day when they conquered Jerusalem. Notice in verse 7, he talks how God went forth before the people, marched through the wilderness. The earth quaked and the heavens poured down rain at the presence of God, and Mount Sinai quaked. As a reference to the events when they came to Sinai. We pass on to the conquest of Canaan, and in verse 12, we find the kings of the armies, they flee, and the women at home divide the spoil. But now at last the ark has come, and it's rested right there on Mount Zion. And what mount is it that God has chosen? Not lofty Mount Hermon up here in the north, not the lofty hills of Bashan up here, but just that little old hill there in Jerusalem. well fortified, maybe hard to climb, but not a very big hill, just a bit of a hill. And yet God has chosen this. And David pictures the proud hills of Bashan and these other places looking in envy, because God didn't choose them. He chose Mount Zion. In verse 15, he says, "O mighty mountain, mountain of Bashan, O many-peaked mountain, mountain of Bashan, why do you look with envy, O many-peaked mountain, at the mount which God desired for his abode, yea, where the Lord will dwell forever?" God has come now, he's the conqueror. And in verse 17, "With mighty chariotry, twice 10,000, thousands upon thousands, the Lord came from Sinai into the holy place. He ascended the high mount, leading captives in his train and receiving gifts among men." The picture here again of the conquest of Jerusalem. The Jebusites melting before the conqueror, bringing their gifts and acknowledgement that David was now Lord and conqueror of them, and the ark now coming into Jerusalem, ascending the mount and entering the sanctuary which David had prepared for it. In verse 24, he refers to the procession, which is referred to also, I believe, in Samuel. "The solemn procession," he says, "O God, the processions of my God, my King, into the sanctuary." The picture of the ark coming with the procession into the temple, or rather into the tent. Verse 25, "The singers in front, the minstrels last, and between them, maidens playing timbrels." The picture of the dancing and the singing that was going on as the ark was coming along the road and up the hill towards the tent. And finally, you come to the end of the psalm, and the ark is now in the tent. Terrible is God in his sanctuary. The ark, symbol of God's presence, now deposited in the temporary sanctuary which David had erected for it in the form of a tent on Mount Zion. And that gives him confidence that this one who has triumphed can give power and strength to his people. The conqueror ascends and blesses his people. If we go across to Psalm 110, I believe we have another psalm here, which probably was written in relation to this conquest of Jerusalem. Now, can you send your mind back a moment to the early references to Jerusalem in the Bible? Jerusalem, formerly called Salem, later it was changed to Jeru-Salem, and the king of Salem, Melchizedek, he was priest-king of this Canaanite city-state, and he was a man so pure and upright in heart that he could be called king of peace, king of righteousness, and priest of the Most High God. And Abraham acknowledged the greatness of Melchizedek, and he acknowledged that the Most High God was the controller of these events when he brought the offerings and offered them to God's representative. But now David has come and he has conquered Jerusalem. He has established his throne there, so he becomes heir of this Melchizedek priest kingship, you might say. And now David, as God's representative, becomes king of peace, king of righteousness, and priest to the Most High God. Not, of course, in the Levitical sense of the word, because David was not from the tribe of Levi, he was from the tribe of Judah, but in the Melchizedek sense. He was not after the order of Levi, he was after the order of Melchizedek, a different sort of priesthood. And so David inherits this throne, and he inherits these titles from Melchizedek. David wrote this psalm, we are told, and it would appear that he wrote it to be sung by the temple singers to celebrate his conquest of Jerusalem. And when you look at it in that light, it certainly makes sense. The singers sing, "The Lord says to my Lord," that is Jehovah, says to David the conqueror, "Sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool." It's almost as if God has invited David to sit in the place of supreme power, and eventually all enemies will be suppressed, because if he can conquer Jerusalem, nothing can withstand him. Jerusalem, that was the one place that withstood Israel's conquest. If you can take that place, you can take any. And so the Lord has invited him, you might say, to this place of supreme conquest, and to wait now, because one by one he can be assured that all his enemies will be conquered. And then in verse 2, "From the hill of Zion we find David ruling his people. The Lord sending forth from Zion the mighty scepter, rule in the midst of your foes. Your people will offer themselves freely on the day you lead your host upon the holy mountains. Here are the people presenting themselves willingly for the king's service in spreading his rule throughout the land. And from the womb of the morning, like dew, your youth will come to you." A picture here of all the youthful people of the nation, all the lusty young men, with all the life-giving freshness of youth, all the strength of youth, all the vigor of manhood, coming and presenting themselves to their king so that they might spread his rule throughout the land. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You're a priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek. David now, like Melchizedek, having an authority which is not limited by time or boundaries, but is going to spread forth from country to country. Then the picture goes on of layer upon layer of the glories which God is going to bring. God leading his king to universal triumph and rule. The Lord is at your right hand, and he will shatter kings on the day of his wrath. He will execute judgment among the nations, filling them with corpses. He'll shatter chiefs over the wide earth. Nothing's going to stop David now, because God is his king, God is the conqueror. And even if he needs refreshment, by the way, God will renew his vigor continually to uphold his lordship. Verse 7, he will drink from the brook, by the way, and so he'll lift up his head and go on in renewed vigor to further triumphs. Well, you only have to read that through to realize that when you apply it to David, it's rather heady stuff. And certainly if you interpret it literally, it can't really be true. But after all, it was a national song of triumph, and most of our national songs do tend to be a bit exaggerated. You only have to think of some of them. Land of Hope and Glory. What do you think of that? We don't take that sort of stuff seriously, I hope. Britannia rules the waves. And poor old Britannia's flatter keeping her head above water. There'll always be an England. Advance Australia fair. Gives you a lump in the throat to say it, doesn't it? These songs of national pride and triumph, really, they do get a bit exaggerated. And the titles that these kings accrue to themselves, have you ever seen the titles that the Shah of Persia used to have? They're not much use to him now, but they were very impressive once. King of Kings, Lord of Lords, the Lion of Judah, and all that sort of thing. Ostrich whose feet devour the desert, and so on. All sorts of titles. You look at any king, title after title after title. So it was with David. Here he is, he had inherited, you might say, all these titles from Melchizedek and all the great ones before him. But that's all they were. They were no more than titles. And you can sing this great song of victory and exalt the king in his hour of triumph if you wish. But it's not literally true. When you come to the New Testament, you find that the Jews understood that psalm as a psalm of the Messiah. And Jesus agreed with them that that was a correct interpretation. In Matthew 22, we have an argument between Jesus and his opponents as to who the Messiah was. And Jesus quotes from this psalm, which every Jew, even those who didn't accept Jesus at all, acknowledged as being a psalm of the Messiah. And Jesus points out, he says, "You people all believe that the Messiah is going to be a great descendant of David, a son of David. Who wrote Psalm 110? And they say, in effect, David. Jesus says, correct. Now, what did David say in the psalm about this one, the Messiah? He said, the Lord, Jehovah says, to my Lord. David calls him my Lord. Now, David calls him my Lord, and yet he's his son. How can he call him my Lord if he's his son? And the Jews are dumbfounded. And Jesus says, in effect, David's son also happens to be David's God, David's Lord, so that the Messiah is not only a descendant of David, he is also God of David. And the Jews found Jesus' argument unanswerable, because there he stood in front of them as the Messiah, who was God, but yet also a descendant of David. Now you can go back over that psalm again, and you can read it a second time, and this time apply it to Jesus Christ himself. And when you apply it to Jesus Christ himself, then you find that what was gross exaggeration in the case of David becomes literal, true, it's fact, when you apply it to Jesus Christ. He was not just a priest in name only. He was not just a king who ruled the world in name only. But his rule is complete and never ending, and his priesthood is complete and never ending. Listen to this. The writer to the Hebrews says, another priest arises in the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become a priest not according to a legal requirement concerning bodily descent, but by the power of an indestructible life. As for David, his tomb is here among us, said the early apostles, and we know that he was buried. But this one, he has the power of an indestructible life, and of him it is witnessed, thou art a priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek. Those who formerly became priests took their office without an oath, But this one was addressed with an oath. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. Thou art a priest forever. And this makes Jesus the surety of a better covenant. The same writer said earlier, to what angel did God ever say, sit at my right hand till I make thy enemies a stool for thy feet? But of Christ it was said, because his kingship is eternal and his priesthood is eternal, and both of them know no bounds. Paul said this, then comes the end when he delivers, that's Jesus, delivers the kingdom to God the Father after destroying every rule and every authority and every power. For he must reign until he has put all enemies under his feet. Not just in some metaphorical way, as we saw in the case of David, but here now, the absolute ruler who ultimately wins universal and eternal triumph. He must reign until he has put all enemies under his feet. Let me conclude by reading this to you. Then I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse. And he who sat upon it is called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he judges and makes war. His eyes are like a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems. And he has a name inscribed which no one knows but himself. He is clad in a robe dipped in blood. And the name by which he is called is the Word of God. And the armies of heaven, arrayed in fine linen, white and pure, followed him on white horses. From his mouth issues a sharp sword with which to smite the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. He will tread the winepress of the fury of the wrath of God the Almighty, and on his robe and on his thigh he has a name inscribed, King of Kings and Lord of Lords.